I see that many of you are still finishing desserts, but we thought we'd go ahead and get started with our program, if that's acceptable. So good afternoon again. It is my distinct pleasure today to present as our speaker a native Hoosier who has been ranked by Forbes magazine as the 96th most powerful woman in the world. Beth Brook is the global vice chair of public policy for EY, as I indicated, formerly Ernst & Young, where she has public policy responsibility for the firm's operations in 140 countries. That automatically makes her an international business celebrity who's in constant demand as a speaker. If her name was familiar to you before she launched her business career, that may be because she was a star basketball player for Purdue, which has one of the country's top programs for women. She holds a bachelor's degree from Purdue with highest distinction, with a major in industrial management and computer science. Ms. Brooks spent the first 10 years of her career here in the Indianapolis office of EY, under the tutelage of Bill Carter and Jack Shaw, who many of you will remember. She is a graduate of the 13th class of the Stanley K. Lacey Executive Leadership Series, moderated by Frank Walker, who's with us today, and who is a longtime supporter of this club. During the Clinton administration, Beth spent 2 years at the Treasury Department, where she was responsible for all tax policy issues related to insurance and managed care. This may bring up some interesting questions in the Q&A. In addition to her regular duties in her current role at EY, she's involved with numerous boards and organizations, including the Aspen Institute, the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and the World Economic Forum, to name but a few. Please join me in welcoming home a Hoosier who makes us all proud of her significant achievements and global prestige, Beth Brook.
Thank you so much, Deborah, and good afternoon. And I am happy to answer any questions in the Q&A about the Clintons, but I'm not going to talk about it in my prepared remarks. It is so wonderful to be back as a Hoosier in Indiana. So many friends from the past are here, and thank you for that. It has just been so lovely to see all of you. I'm really touched. I loved spending the first 10 years of my career here and of growing up, and spending the first 10 years of my career here in the same city with my brother, David Millard, who many of you probably know. I am who I am today in large part because of my big brother kicking my rear end around the basketball court every day growing up together in Kokomo. He's always been a great confidant of mine, and I'm very proud of what he's accomplished in his career here in Indianapolis at Barnes & Thornburg. And also, much to my surprise, my nephew showed up today, who is in his residency here at IU, and I'm delighted to have him as well. I want to thank the Economic Club for inviting me today, in particular Frank Walker, and Deborah, thank you, and Michelle Hodge for all your help. I loved attending these luncheons during my days at Ernst & Winnie, one of the predecessors to EY, back when I was here. And congratulations to the Economic Club on your 40th anniversary. Now, I never get nervous when I speak. I just don't. But this time, I did, big time. Why? Well, because, as Deborah said, back in the 1980s, I had the incredible fortune to be a member of SKL Class 13, where I got to know some of the great future leaders of Indianapolis. And they are here today at a table right out there that I can no longer see in the lights, but I know you're right over there because I saw you earlier. So why am I nervous? Well, because I would welcome the opportunity to sit where you're sitting and listen to any one of them speak. And impart their wisdom. So our class was had just incredible camaraderie and wisdom. So thanks for all of you for being here. And that is in no small part due to our moderator and mentor of SKL Class 13, the great Frank Walker, as Deborah mentioned. Everyone in this room knows Frank, but I have to tell you, our class really knows Frank. He not only moderated us 25 years ago, he's kept us together ever since. As recently as last night, where he and his lovely wife, Jane, hosted our entire class and our partners and spouses for dinner in their home. That's an incredible mentor and moderator. This is one very special man in Indiana, as was our class, is lucky to have had him all these years. One more round of applause for Frank. Okay, I was serious. I really was nervous for this. So I emailed Andy Marshall, who many of you know. She ran the SKL program some 25 plus years ago. I emailed Andy Marshall and I asked her, what in the heck do you think this audience would want to hear from me? And within 30 seconds, literally 30 seconds, Andy Marshall emailed me right back with her advice. Here goes. Just pretend we're around a campfire and they've asked you what you've learned lately and how you think it's going to impact the future for them and their communities. Then take a deep breath and an imaginary sip of wine and just start talking. So, thanks, Andy. Here goes. What I've learned lately and why it matters. First, the impacts and lessons of globalization. I'm not sure I've learned this lately. It's more like a frog sitting in a pot of boiling water. But what I have learned is that nobody today, nobody in this world that is complex, uncertain, volatile, or ambiguous can possibly have all the answers. But even without clear answers, we just have to engage, especially in the emerging markets, either by doing business in them or just making sure we understand what's going on in them so that we can do what we do better. Growth in the emerging markets is continuing to outpace the developed markets. We all know that. And while no country was spared from the economic crisis in which every country in the world saw a slowing of their growth, the emerging markets are continuing to grow at over twice the rate of the developed markets. For example, China, we're all aware, is the second largest economy, and it's anticipated to eclipse the United States in our lifetimes. But I'd like to focus for a moment on another emerging market, Brazil, because I think that country actually bears watching, in particular for Indiana. Brazil's growth has been fueled by their extensive natural resources, their diverse agricultural and manufacturing sectors, and their great consumer culture. A good number of the regional jets that actually fly into Indiana's airports are designed and built in Brazil. Between 2000 and 2012, Brazil more than doubled its soybean production from 1.4 billion bushels to over 3 billion bushels. This year, Indiana produced about 225 million bushels. In 2002, Brazil's economy was ranked number 13, and just 10 years later, it's number 7. Brazil will host the World Cup in 2014 and the Olympics in Rio in 2016. Now, because of the significance of Brazil, I know for EY, for the first time ever, we actually decided to sponsor the Olympics in Rio in 2016. And we also made a significant acquisition in Brazil a couple of years ago to catapult ourselves from last to first position in Brazil. Significant foreign direct investment flowing into Brazil is not just coming from the United States and the developed markets. More increasingly, it's coming from the emerging markets, E to E, in particular from China into Brazil. The real action today is clearly in these emerging markets like Brazil, but in part it's because they are not encumbered by the progress of the past. And what do I mean by that? Well, I recall being in South America back in the 90s. I was up on a mountain. I was visiting an innovative farming operation. It was powered by one computer, one electrical wire, run 5 miles up that mountain. And I remember as if it were yesterday turning to the CEO I was with, and I said, can you imagine the economic explosion when wireless is available to this region? Well, it's here and it's there. And those nations can now move swiftly because they don't have to undo a bunch of infrastructure like the U.S. has to undo in order to leap forward. And that's really what we're witnessing. Economies that are essentially unencumbered by the landlines are moving swiftly as they adapt the mobile technologies to their advantage, while the U.S. and more developed countries struggle with that evolution. Today, there are 100 people online in Brazil, about half the population, and that's the same penetration rate as in the U.S. in 2001. What that's doing is giving rise to an enormous growing middle class. And while the middle class in the U.S. has been squeezed over the past decade, we've actually seen the middle across emerging markets exploding. By 2015, the UN predicts that the middle class in China, India, and Brazil will have propelled those countries' economies to account for nearly half of our world output. Simply, this has implications for all of our businesses, and those implications are immense. New consumers, new suppliers, and new markets. Now, everything I just said about Brazil, everything, and the reasons it's a country to watch apply to another market. Because this market that I want to talk about is emerging with the same kind of incredible force, but most people don't even realize it, and they stand to miss a big opportunity. What market am I talking about? Women. Nearly 1 billion women will enter the workforce and become entrepreneurs over the next 10 years. The impact of those women and what they will have on the global economy will be at least as significant as that of China and India's respective 1 billion plus populations, if not greater. Now think about that. If you're a CEO, you would not think of not investing in China. You would not think of not investing in India. So why would you think of not investing in women? All I can suggest is pay attention. Are you thinking about women as your consumers? They control 85% of the purchasing decisions. Are you designing products with them in mind? Do you have men designing products that women will make the purchasing decision for? What percentage of your workforce are women? Do you have women on your board? Are they part of your senior leadership? Are you thinking about the impact on your products and services and on your workforce of an additional 1 billion women suddenly becoming economically empowered? If the answer is no, you might be missing a big opportunity. The economic uptake from the economic empowerment of 1 billion women will be even, I think, more significant than they've already projected. Why? Well, when women earn income, research shows that when women earn income, they actually reinvest 90% of that income in their families, in their children's education, in the health and welfare of their communities. When men earn income, guys, you reinvest about 30% in your communities. I don't know what you do with the rest. I do not. But you can see the multiplier effect generated by investing in women. Said differently, if I were sitting in Japan today, which I do often, and I talk about this a lot when I'm in Japan, I would invest in women. Women are completely untapped in the economy of Japan, totally excluded, but they're very highly educated. So Japan could turn on that faucet tomorrow by economically empowering women in Japan in their workforce and as entrepreneurs. And Prime Minister Abe realizes that women are an untapped economic engine that could save Japan and will. My point, your company may be very much like Japan. Why should any of this matter to Indianapolis or the state of Indiana? Well, because in the globalized world of the 21st century, difference matters. I think it is perhaps the most important thing, frankly, I could share with you rather than talk about a bunch of public policy things. I think this matters a whole lot to Indiana. Back in 1998, McKinsey conducted a year-long study involving 77 companies and almost 6,000 managers. And they found that the most important corporate resource over the next 20 years will be talent. Smart, sophisticated business people who are technologically literate, globally astute, and operationally agile. We are getting close to that 20-year mark, and it's very clear that McKinsey called it right. Winning companies of the future and winning regions of the future will be those that attract, retain, and grow the best talent at every level, from the field to the workplace to the boardroom. And like every other place in the world, Indiana is going to have to compete for talent. And you know better than I the brain drain issues that Indiana faces. Competition for talent is a real issue. Back in 2010, in an interview, EY's chairman was asked how he had come to focus so much on diversity inclusiveness at our firm. And he responded by saying, "We're in the service business. We have no equipment, no machinery, no fixed assets, no inventory. All we have are our ideas and our people. And every one of our assets goes home every night, and we need them to want to come back the next morning." Well, talent is only going to want to come back to us and you the next morning and stay with us if they feel like their perspectives and opinions matter. We conduct a global people survey of all of our people around the world. The number one answer to the question that correlates most to the retention of our people is, do I feel like my opinions are valued? It's the highest correlation to the retention of our people. If they feel like their perspectives and opinions matter, they want to stay. And not just that they matter when their opinion reflects your opinion, but even more so when their opinion doesn't reflect your opinion. Great talent wants to be embraced because of their unique perspectives. That's how innovation is catalyzed, and that's the kind of mindset we all have to have in our businesses. The discomfort found in surrounding yourself with people who don't look, think, and act like yourself is where good things actually can happen. Indiana is a state of many strengths. From a global perspective, and remember, I'll keep coming back to this because your competition is global. Indiana has many strengths. The state, as you all know, has a great agricultural base. 83% of Indiana's acres are devoted to either farms or forests. Very favorable corporate tax rate, 7.5% going down to 6.5% in 2015. It's one of the top 10 most tax-friendly states. Good and stable state government, thanks to Mitch. Which is generally trusted, and a lack of corruption, which unfortunately are not the hallmarks of Brazil. These strengths are huge pluses for the state of Indiana, but you have to be careful to not just compare yourself to where you've come from and what you have now, but instead we also have to look at the progress and innovation that the global challengers are making. Now, you know the challenges that Indiana face better than I do. Indiana has great higher education, including IU, my alma mater, Purdue, Ball State, Butler, a great higher education, but that the elementary and secondary education needs to be upgraded. The American Legislative Exchange Council gave the schools a C+ and ranked Indiana 17th in the nation. Now, that's not a horrible grade by any stretch, but when you want to achieve an A+ in excellence, this just won't get you there. Two more challenges, infrastructure and connectivity. Indianapolis can point with such great pride to the new airport. I love the new airport. It's indeed a great upgrade for the city. But last year, Brazil's president outlined a plan to build more than 800 new regional airports, and the government is seeking to attract $90 billion in private investment to upgrade its roads, its railways, and its ports. That's the competition. So, how does Indiana succeed given these strengths and challenges? How? Well, I'm not going to offer some philosophical theory or platitudes, which will maybe sound good, but offer no real tools for help. Investments in agriculture, education, and infrastructure are certainly important, as I've indicated. But I think we'll never reach our full potential if we don't invest and engage in all of our people. So let me offer a concrete suggestion. Difference matters. And you can use difference to a strategic competitive advantage. Since we are so globalized, and we now do business, all of us, all over the world with all kinds of people, the United States has a distinct advantage. We're already more diverse by the nature of how our country was created. We are already more diverse than many other countries, and Indiana can indeed capitalize on that. Our teams, our customers, your customers will be more diverse whether we like it or not. That's a given, and it requires that we work to take into account their diverse perspectives and viewpoints and turn them into a competitive advantage. Now, let me say more about that. Research shows, and this is some of the most significant research I think there is right now, research shows that a diverse team will outperform a homogeneous team that looks, acts, and thinks alike. A diverse team will outperform a homogeneous team in solving a complex problem every time. Even if the homogeneous team's trained on the particular problem they're trying to solve, the diverse team will outperform it every time. Why? Because of all of those diverse perspectives and opinions. But the magic in this research says that a diverse team will outperform a homogeneous team every time only if well-led. diverse teams actually rarely perform kind of middle of the road. They're either off the charts good or they are just awful. Why? Again, it comes down to the leader. Does he or she know how to lead and manage a group of different perspectives? Does it, you know, disintegrate into friction and chaos amongst the dissent and differing opinions? Or is it well managed to get the innovative creativity out of the diverse group? Great teams and great companies are getting this right, and the ones who aren't are starting to fall behind. This requires inclusive leadership. We have to ask ourselves, are ideas from all sources welcome? Is there a respect for the differences that exist? Do team members trust each other? If the answer to those questions is no, then the team is likely going to fail. But if the answer is yes, the magic of innovating for the future will occur. Now, what I've learned from serving some of the world's greatest companies, both large and entrepreneurial, is that when you have diverse perspectives at the table being well led, you are able to innovate more and problem solve more quickly and creatively to a competitive advantage. I'm actually consulting about once a week these days with U.S.-based companies, with a U.S.-based company's most senior leadership on how to do this. They're increasingly recognizing that when their leadership all looks, thinks, and acts alike, they're actually in trouble. And the problem is, what got them there was years in the making. They can't undo it overnight, but they know it's causing them to face a lack of innovation, risk of groupthink, and falling behind. And it's not easy to undo that, to get to the point to realize that difference matters and gets it working to their strategic advantage. At EY, we didn't build a diverse and inclusive culture overnight. It's been an enormously long journey, and we are still on it. And the truth about D&I at EY is that we started by focusing on women. 20 years later, after we started our intense focus on women, we realized that we had all these diverse teams, but we hadn't equipped the leaders of those teams with how to lead a group of people who actually think differently. We started actually asking our people around the world. Here's what we found. We found some people who really saw the magic of diversity and difference and different perspectives, and they believed it passionately. And then you'd talk to other people in a private moment when they wouldn't worry about being politically correct, and they'd tell you it was the worst experience of their lives. The diverse team was dysfunctional, it was inefficient, people fought, they didn't make good decisions. Why? When we really started to look at it, we saw this issue about leadership. Those who had good experience had been well led, those who had a poor experience had been poorly led. So now we're very focused on leadership of differences to produce creative solutions. It's not human nature, it's hard. It's actually harder to lead a team that doesn't look, act, and think like you, so we're very sympathetic to that. I know Indiana's up to seizing the opportunity that challenge offers. Why? Well, some of it has to do with that great Midwestern work ethic, that unwavering, pragmatic, and dogmatic belief that hard work and perseverance rooted in quiet humility pays off in the long run. Guess what? I think it does. I actually think I'm a living example of that. My dad used to tell me, about once a week, in all honesty, my nephew would not remember that, but he said, girl, you've been given gifts. Use them. And know that tomorrow you're going to fall on your face. His point was, success isn't good enough. Success is necessary, but be successful and then use your success to be significant. Do something with it that matters, and never get too full of yourself, because you could lose it all tomorrow. I loved my dad. So for dad, let me share just one last thing that I've learned and why it matters. 2 years ago, at age 52, I'm 54, 2 years ago, at age 52, 31 years into my career, I came out. I came out as a leader who is gay. To that point, my personal career journey had been more about being a woman than being a gay woman. Having to overcome the hurdles of being a woman who also happened to be a Democrat and an introvert. In a profession filled with male Republican extroverts. Not everyone, but an awful lot. Trust me, I have been pretty different for my entire journey. But there was this one more difference. But it was invisible. And I wasn't out for 52 years of life or 31 years of a career at EY nor in the Clinton administration. as a woman, when I started here in Indianapolis, I didn't feel excluded at all, not for a long while. I was an athlete and I was a competitor. I fit into a man's world. It was easier for me than most because of that, especially here in Indiana, having played basketball at Purdue, as you can imagine. It was easier to not be who I really was. I even married and divorced. That served as a great cover for a very long time. I was named to the Forbes list, as Deborah said, of the world's 100 most powerful women for 6 straight years. And that was an incredible platform to do even more things of significance. And it helped me to leverage being a woman to great advantage around the world. But all the while, I was deeply closeted, fearful of being defined by anything other than a great leader and a great professional. Then, one February, our LGBT at EY, we call it the Beyond Group, but our LGBT network leader in the United States came to me and asked me to be the closer on an EY video for the Trevor Project. You may have heard of that. The Trevor Project was going to run an It Gets Better campaign, and the Trevor Project is focused on the issue of suicide among gay teens. And our LGBT professionals would be on this video telling how their lives got better at Ernst & Young, and the message to the teens watching the video would be just hang in there, life gets better, even though you may be thinking of suicide as a young teen. They came to me as a straight ally. I'd always been a great straight ally of the group, and they said, will you be the senior most leader in the firm, closer on the video from the message of just a senior leader in the firm. They asked me that in February. So comes May. I'm on a plane. I was reviewing files for the next day and come across this file, read a script for a video I've got to shoot the next day, and it's about this Trevor Project. I read the script. My team had written it. From the perspective of a straight ally, I read it and I thought, wow, all right. And I'm talking to teens at home, sitting there thinking of them killing themselves, and I'm not going to be authentic. So I'd had a glass of wine, pulled out a sheet of paper and said, if I said what I really wanted to say, here's what I'd say. And I scratched it out on a piece of paper. So the next day, I went to the video shoot, and I handed my script to the teleprompter person. I said, why don't we load this one in? Keep in mind, so we're in this video. It's the teleprompter guy, the camera guy, and our two leaders of our LGBT network. And I read what I'm supposed to read. And our LGBT leaders are just standing there going, really? Really? So that video was to be released to all Ernst & Young people and the public, not for another month. We were being honored by Ernst & Young, EY, Steve and I mess it up once in a while. EY was being honored by the Trevor Project for all of our work in the LGBT area, and so we were going to be honored that night at a gala dinner, and I was asked to give the acceptance speech on behalf of the firm, and that video was going to go public the next morning after the award dinner. So all of that was unknown other than two people and the cameraman for a month. And for that month, our two LGBT leaders came to me every day and kind of just talked me through it. Just said, you know what you're about to do? Let's talk about it. The upside, the downside, what's going to happen, your life's going to change, good, bad, all of it. You still want to go? You still want to do this? I'm like, yeah, still want to do this. So that night at the Trevor Project dinner on behalf of EY, I'm giving the acceptance speech, having written all my own remarks, saluting, saying all the right things, saluting all the right people. And about 3/4 of the way through the video, or through the acceptance speech, I mentioned that our video is going to be released the next morning. And then I utter the phrase in my acceptance speech for the firm, as a leader who is gay. Keep in mind, at that point in time, I think I'm the biggest coward hypocrite in the world, because for 52 years of life and 31 years of a career, I've been silent. And I think I'm going to get booed because it's a pretty gay audience, and I just think I'm the biggest hypocrite in the world, but I was going to come out. So, as a leader who is gay, and before I can get the next word out of my mouth, somebody yells from that side of the room, and I'm like, here come the boos, here it comes. And then there was clapping, then there was a 5-minute standing ovation. And I stood there, tears rolling down my face, and I'm like, what's happening? And I did not understand the significance of it. And finally, when they sat, I started again, and all that came out of my mouth was a whisper, as a leader who is gay. And Mike, I had no voice. And it was 52 years of silence broken. And then I just continued on, and I could feel my voice recover, and that was the end of my beginning. as the start of a whole new chapter as a totally authentic leader, as a better leader, and as a better person. 33 years now into a very successful career, I am learning more than I could possibly imagine. The positive reaction and support has been overwhelming. None of the negative that I feared and none of my own crazy internal fear has surfaced. So, what was my biggest learning after the video was released? My biggest learning was difference matters, and it matters to everyone. I got thousands of emails, and I wished I had saved them and published them in a book. Thousands of emails I received from gay people, straight people, parents with gay kids, all over the world, with everyone sharing their personal stories. And you know what that was in those stories? Every one of them. It was about when they walk out their door every morning, just like all of us in this room, there's this little self-doubt. They feel a little bit different. They feel a little bit uncertain, and they just want their difference to matter and be valued. I had somehow, in my coming out in the message on the video, given them permission to feel good about their difference, because I said it mattered to me and it mattered to EY, and we valued them for it, not in spite of it. This is about all of us. Everyone wants their perspectives valued and heard, and everyone wants to succeed by being who they are, not by having to conform to something that they're not. So I want to close with a few lessons learned in the early days of my new chapter. We don't need a shelf for special people. Everyone is special and made so by their difference, and everyone is different. Role models. We talk a lot about role models, but I see their power in a whole new light. Leadership is about being who you are so others can be who they are and know that they will be valued for it. They don't actually want to be like you. They just want you to be who you are so they can see you being successful, that they know that they can then be who they are and be valued for it and make a difference in doing so. Now, I have to say one other thing. Being who I am so others can be who they are allowed me to meet the love of my life in the last 2 years. Only by being our authentic selves did we actually find each other. And I cannot imagine life without her. She's a great role model in her own right. Michelle Marciniak, who's actually here today, is an incredible entrepreneur. But before that, she played basketball at Tennessee, was a legend. She played for won a national championship for Pat Summitt as her point guard, and then went on to play in the WNBA, and now is a very successful entrepreneur. What's more important about Michelle, though, is she is the most deep, strong, incredible leader who is one of the most kind, humble individuals I've ever met, and she has every reason not to be. She's an incredible role model for women in sports, women who want to pivot into business, and the humility that comes from just what we recognize here in the Midwest. And what we're learning together today is what it means to be role models on this particular issue of being gay, and we haven't figured that out. In business, Frank Walker was a role model to our SKL class. He was totally authentic with us, just as he is today. He shared his business and his personal certainties and uncertainties, and he was who he was, and we then knew we could be who we were, and we would have an equal chance of becoming the next Frank Walker. The more senior we get, I think the more important that is. People just can't be what they can't see. So they need to see themselves in us, their senior leaders. Again, not to be like us, but to feel good about being who they are with their unique perspectives and differences. Only then can we get the best from them as our employees and the most innovation for our businesses. As leaders, as authentic, inclusive leaders, we need to value difference. Not only to value difference, but to be able to lead in a world of difference. We have to challenge ourselves as we think about the behaviors of great inclusive leaders. Do you value difference, or does it frighten you? Are you comfortable in the chaos of viewpoints that differ from your own? Do you try to meet people where they are, in their cultural underpinnings and their background of human experiences, or do you operate through the lens of your own experiences? Do you make difference safe to be expressed, or do you dismiss ideas that aren't aligned with your own? Do you listen before you talk? Do you seek to challenge any decision that gets made by people who look, think, and act alike by going to look for views that are different from those of that group? Or don't you? I know I try to check myself on those answers every day. As I travel amongst the emerging markets all over the world, honestly, I try to listen more than I talk. For when we listen more than we talk, only then can we discover and embrace the differences that will help make us successful and hopefully indeed significant. So Deborah, you want to take some questions?
Yes. First, thank you so much. So, Beth, you seem fearless now, but doing a little research on you, I saw that you told an interviewer that you're actually insecure. Why is that?
Good question. Yeah, I'm very insecure, and I think it's a quest for perfection, and always expecting the best in you. I think as sort of an athlete. Growing up, there was nothing I didn't think that, you know, if you didn't do it well today, you had a chance to go improve it tomorrow. You could get up, you could work harder. And I think it came in some sense from my dad, always saying, don't ever get too full of yourself. You could fall on your face tomorrow. And there was just always that underlying, you just need to keep working a little bit harder, practice a little bit harder, work a little bit harder, and you'll be better. But you'll never be good enough. And that bred a little insecurity probably.
Well, you've talked a lot about leadership and leading diverse groups, and there are sort of a number of questions associated with that. And they center around how do you accomplish that kind of leadership? Are women better at it than men? And do you have any ideas on how to integrate these ideas on the importance of team leadership into government? Mm.
Yeah, that's a great question. So many thoughts. This isn't about women being better than men, not at all. It is about we need women and men because the power is in the diversity of the perspectives. So you need both. We just did some research at EY, 22,000 engagements we looked at, and gender-balanced teams outperformed gender-unbalanced teams, either all male, all female, significantly outperformed. It's the power is in the diverse perspectives, and that's what's important. Are women better at it? You know, I do believe, and this comes from personal experience, women have an awful lot of practice over their lifetimes of leading from the foot of the table rather than the head of the table. It's just where they've been, is where we've been. And you, when you lead from the foot of the table, you have to get really good at influence and persuasion and cajoling and really listening well and getting everybody on board. So I think that this concept of inclusive leadership comes a little more comfortably to women. I don't know that they're, and it makes them just a little bit better at it. It doesn't make women better than men. I think it's a perspective of where we come from. Having said that, let me pivot into government, where we just saw in the recent debt issues, it was really Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, who actually led the effort to try to drive a compromise. And it was a group of women senators who got that going and actually pushed it through. And we might not be in the same situation we are today were it not for that group of women. And I can tell you from being very close to the women senators, they meet all the time across the aisle. They work beautifully across the aisle. They don't always agree, heavens no. They fight, they bicker, but they know how to drive compromise. And it's very refreshing to see, given back in the 90s when I was in the administration and witnessed the era of the real poison develop in Washington in those 94 elections, and it's really never been the same since. And there is just it's a very unhealthy environment at this point. And I love to see what the women senators are doing. It reminds me of sort of my early days in the government. And I'm hopeful that as we get more women, we'll maybe get things driven a little bit back to a more reasonable state.
One of our questioners says, I love the message of pro-women growth for my daughter. But some say boys are getting left behind a bit too of late. What do you say for the future of my son?
I think that the world is his oyster. There are so many opportunities. The optimism for the world, in my mind, is in entrepreneurship, whether it's in developed countries or in the emerging markets. And there is no group in the world that's particularly advantaged when it comes to entrepreneurism and innovation and ideas. And I think that it's such a great and healthy environment of how we see the world growing and a bit more understanding of difference, frankly, in the younger generations. I think that the thing we're caught in is, as I said, with the companies that I tend to consult a lot with today, is where we are from a leadership level is just a product of where we've been, and it's hard to change that overnight. Our younger generation doesn't suffer that same fate.
We got a few questions on this. One of them I had scribbled down myself. You talked so eloquently about competitiveness, the need for diversity, and your own experience in having the courage to come out. Indiana has passed once a resolution that would prohibit gay marriage as well as civil unions. And so we have a few questions about how that would affect, in your view, our ability to attract diverse talent in terms of global competitiveness.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's a question that companies are increasingly wrestle with. We are at EY. I will tell you that we now, it's not infrequently that we have employees be quite well aware of that and not want to move to a state or to a country where it is not supported. We deal with this a lot. In the U.S., there's still 29 states where you can be fired for being gay. And in the world, there's countries where I have to travel to where I could be thrown in jail, and it's a criminal offense. That does cause you to be a little nervous when you're there. And it certainly causes employees for all companies to question whether they want to work. So, and I do think some of the motivation towards states passing the laws that they've passed that favor gay marriage have an economic, you know, drive behind them. It's not just all where they stand on the social issue. There's an economic cost and an economic benefit to the state.
And in terms of other competitiveness issues, we have a question via Twitter, I might add. Is regulatory burden a hindrance or a help for U.S. companies in the global marketplace?
Regulatory burden is a cost and a hindrance to everyone everywhere. It is really interesting. I talked a lot about the growth of the emerging markets, but one thing that's happening globally is as the emerging markets are emerging, they're wanting to have more of a voice on the global regulatory scene. So whether it's in the G20 or in the various governing bodies, that emerging market voice is becoming more empowered, and it's putting more sand in the gears of getting things done. So in some sense, it's causing more regulatory disharmonization. Countries, the emerging markets are becoming more national protective, as are the developed markets. There is not global harmonization going on. It's sort of global disharmonization. It's making it extraordinarily difficult for business. And no matter what business you're in, you're feeling that. I know Derek and I, we feel like we're the only business in the world that seems to just be under attack globally. Not true. Every business, every sector, every industry is really struggling with this, trying to manufacture products and services to different standards all over the world, having your business regulated in a different way all over the world. And so you say, so what's the prognosis? Where we go from here? It's the same thing that applies to Washington. There is not going to be any big grand bargain, either in the United States or around the world around regulatory harmonization. There is going to be no big grand bargain. The only way we're going to start to see harmonization in Washington or among countries around the world is in very small steps as trust gets built. And what we see right now is nobody's trying to build trust. We sort of miss those great leaders who recognize that and would work hard behind the scenes at trying to build trust. One of the things that harms that is really, frankly, our technology, everybody's on all the time. It is very, very hard to build trust behind the scenes because everything you do now is visible and under a microscope, and that sort of disrupts the dynamic of that to some extent. But small steps, small building of trust, that's the only way that the world's going to come back to harmonization, which I think is quite possible. I'm actually optimistic. I didn't sound that way.
That's helpful. And how helpful do you feel tax reform would be for growth in the U.S. economy?
Tax reform in the U.S. is very necessary. We have the highest tax rate in the world, and we have an archaic tax system. So tax reform is absolutely necessary. It's going to take building trust one step at a time to get it there. We lack leadership on the issue. It's going to take some very difficult decisions. And in some sense, when you look at what has to happen in the U.S., if you take any one of these things in isolation, they can't get done. Tax reform can't get done as tax reform. You've got to look at immigration issues, our out-of-control entitlements, and tax reform and education reform, four things all at once in order to be able to do any of them. And that takes enormous leadership, but that is what I think it's going to take. Anyone in isolation, we can see we're not making progress on.
And perhaps the follow-up is, do you see us achieving any of this in the current climate?
I'm glad you said in the current climate, because the answer in the current climate is no. I think it's going to take really strong and different leadership. I am a fan of Hillary Clinton, by the way.
One of our commercials. Getting to the rest of the world, is the political landscape in emerging economies prepared to embrace 1 billion women, or is that going to be a barrier?
What was the political landscape
in these emerging economies?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's the political landscape and the cultural. Frankly, what's more difficult in the emerging markets is the cultural underpinnings for women. Like in Korea, very difficult. Japan, very difficult for women. But more and more countries are realizing that it is in their economic best interest to really work to change their cultural underpinnings. And this is where I think all of us in this room come into play. It is incumbent upon multinational corporations to look at our cultures, our global values, our global cultures, and intersect those with the local markets in which we operate in, but stay true to our values and our cultures and try to bring along local cultures that disadvantage people. And that's where what we're finding is we need to work with companies. If we combine the economies of the companies in this room, we would be so far larger than any country's individual economy. We have incredible economic power. Our economies are bigger than a lot of countries. And so if we can band together four or five of us in a country along similar values, we can actually make a good dent in some of the local issues for on certain issues. And I'm seeing a lot more of that going on around the world.
And we've been asked how you feel potential population concerns, such as shrinking families and aging, will affect the predictions relating to China's future in particular, but maybe other countries as well.
Yeah, it's a big problem for China. I mean, the demographics there are very difficult. It is why women have to save Japan. When you look at the insular culture of Japan and their aging demographics, I mean, women have to save Japan. It's just the obvious economic answer. China has real difficulties with their population, and it will always be a significant economic powerhouse, but it's why I think countries like Brazil are very much worth watching.
Beth, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Beth's taller than I am. Let me move these mics down. Thank you so much, Beth, for taking time to speak with us today. And thank you for your courage. Today's presentation will be broadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 FM on Monday, December 2nd at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and is also available for download at WFYI.org. Please join us next month on Wednesday, December 18th, to hear from Jim Guyette, President and CEO of Rolls-Royce North America. Be sure to purchase your tickets today to hear one of the leading experts in the aviation industry. Information and tickets for each of this season's presenters can be found at economicclubofindiana.com. Thank you and have a wonderful afternoon.